Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now covering Zechariah chapter 6, which I will entitle The Eighth Vision, The Four Chariots, and The Branch. Zechariah is receiving his eighth vision on a night in 519 BC, early 519. The temple has been, construction on the temple has been started in 520 as the exiles are trying to reestablish the temple after they came back about 538 from Babylon. And so we begin now in Zechariah 6, verses 1 through 3. Zechariah is speaking, and he says, "Now I lifted up my eyes again and looked, and behold, four chariots were coming forth from between the two mountains, and the mountains were bronze mountains. With the first chariot were red horses, with the second chariot black horses, with the third chariot white horses, and with the fourth chariot strong dappled horses." Now, what do these four chariots signify? Opinions are split all over as to what they mean. Let me give you some examples. The four gospels. The apostles of Christ carrying the gospel into the world. Here's a more reasonable suggestion. The four winds of heaven. Fred Miller, a contemporary commentator, says that. Matthew Henry. Cambridge mentions this as an option. Colin Delitzsch affirms it positively as what it means. Well, after all, that's what Zechariah 6:5 directly says. Zechariah 6:5 reads this way, "The angel told me, these are the four spirits of heaven." And, of course, spirits is the same thing as wind. I imagine the word is ruach. I didn't look it up, but I'm sure it is. "These are the four winds of heaven going out after presenting themselves to the Lord of the whole earth." So these four chariots represent four winds according to this view. And I think that's pretty reasonable. Another option, the four chariots represent the four world powers that are hostile to Israel. And then, of those who hold that view, they are split on who the world powers are. Lee Smith says it's the Medes and the Persians and Egypt and the eastern powers of Edom and Ammon and Moab. Because the black and white horses are sent to the north, those are the Medes and the Persians. The dappled horse is sent to the south, that represents Egypt. And the red horse implicitly, by default, goes to the eastern powers. He's not mentioned, but there's nowhere else for him to go. Now, some people say the four chariots represent the four world empires in Daniel. Babylon, Persia, the Greek kingdom under Alexander the Great, and Rome. Benson holds this view. Cambridge mentions it as an option, and the pulpit commentary denies it. The red horse would stand for the Babylonians, the black would stand for the Persians, the white would be Alexander the Great's Greek kingdom, and the dappled horse would be the Romans. But Adam Clark says the dappled horse is not the Romans. It's Alexander the Great's four successor kingdoms. Well, you can see there's no unanimity on this issue. Lee Smith says the four chariots are four angels sent to patrol the earth. So either it's the wind that's blowing or four angels patrolling the earth. And of course, the reason the angels would be patrolling the earth is to make sure that the earth is peaceful so that the Israelites can rebuild the temple, which is the theme of the whole book of Zechariah. Now, if the option is the four winds of heaven, then you've got to think, well, what's the point? What's the big deal about wind blowing from north, east, south, and west? I don't know. I suppose the reason would be to carry out God's will. Four spirits, four angels representing four winds, angels coming from four directions, in order to make sure that the land is safe so that the temple could be rebuilt. Now, the colors of the horses, the opinions as to what those colors represent, they are also as variegated and diverse as views on what the horses are. Here's some options. Option number one, the colors have no meaning at all because there is no one-to-one correspondence between the direction of the horse and the color of the horse. The black and white horses go north, so what? There's no mention of where the red horses go. There's just nothing to tie the direction of a horse with the color. Option number two is to what the colors mean. Adam Clark says they correspond to Daniel's four world empires. Red, white, black, and dappled. Why? I don't know. Another option, option three, is the four colors represent the same judgments that we see in the four horsemen of the apocalypse in Revelation 6. The red horse stood for blood and war, the black horse stood for famine, and the white horse stood for victory of Jesus. Of course, some people say it's the Antichrist, but that's nonsense. It's Jesus. And the dappled horse, according to this view, the dappled horse in Zechariah 6 corresponds to the pale horse in Revelation 6, or the ashen horse, depends on how you translate it. That's the pale green color, and that stands for death. Well, again, I don't know how you know that. Now, I'm going to show you that the horses that we see in these visions do not correspond with each other. Let me read you what a website called truthnet.org says about the dappled horse that's mentioned in verse 3 here in Zechariah 6. Essentially, the term means spotted, but there is not a point of reference to draw upon a meaning and its application here. In other words, nobody knows what those colors mean. Now, I've got a table here that compares horse number 1, 2, 3, and 4 in Zechariah 6, Zechariah 1, and Revelation 6. And I'm going to compare these horses to show you how there is no correspondence. In Zechariah 6, the first horse is red with a chariot. In Zechariah 1, the red horse is red with the angel of the Lord riding on him, probably the angel of the Lord. Revelation 6, the first horse is a white horse, not a red horse, with a rider and a bow. That would be Jesus. The second horse in Zechariah 6 is a black horse with a chariot. In Zechariah 1, it's a red horse. In Revelation 6, is a red horse with a sword. Horse number 3, Zechariah 6, is a white horse with chariot, or horses with chariot. Zechariah 1, it's a speckled horse. Revelation 6, it's a black horse with rider and scales. The colors don't even match all the way across. The fourth horse in Zechariah 6 is a dappled horse with a chariot. In Zechariah 1, it's a white horse, or white horses. And in Revelation 6, it's a pale horse and a rider. So you see, there's no connections with the horses, so I don't think we need to worry ourselves too much about what those horses stand for. Now, the four chariots being pulled by these four horses came between two mountains in Zechariah's vision. These mountains were bronze mountains. Now, here are some suggestions as to what those bronze mountains represent. Option number 1, gateway to the courts of heaven. Option number 2, the twin pillars at the entrance to the temple called Jachin and Boaz. So the mountains represent the entrance to where God lives. You go between Jachin and Boaz, you go into the temple, that's where God lives. So you go between these two bronze mountains, you go into heaven where God lives. Option number 3, the two bronze mountains represent, quote, the strong barriers of God's purposes. That's Adam Clark. Gill, Henry, and Poole agree with that sentiment. Clark says, the strong barriers of God's purposes which restrained those powers within the times and limits appointed by Jehovah. John Gill says, quote, very ancient the mountains were, earlier than the everlasting hills, high and deep, not to be reached and searched into. They are dark, obscure, and hidden to men, till made known, and are firm, solid, and immovable, and are lasting and durable, and like mountains of brass are never to be broken in pieces, revoked, made null and void, for they stand upon the unalterable will of God. Matthew Poole says, they are, quote, the immovable decrees of God, his steady executions of his counsels, the insuperable restraints upon all empires and councils, which God keeps within the barriers of such impregnable mountains. The pulpit commentator says of these two mountains, these impregnable, undecaying mountains represent the immovable, invincible nature of the theocracy of God's decrees respecting it. Well, that sort of gives you the idea. The two mountains are God's fixed purposes, according to option number 3. Option number 4, the two mountains are the Mount of Olives and Mount Zion. Pulpit mentions this as an option because the Hebrew says the two mountains. So some say, well, if it's the two mountains, it must be the Mount of Olives and Mount Zion with the Kidron Valley in between. Mount of Olives and Mount Zion were apparently associated with strength and judgment. Guzik, the dispensational commentator, says that this is the majority opinion that the two bronze mountains represent the Mount of Olives and Mount Zion. Option number 5, the two bronze mountains are Mount Moriah and Mount Zion. Mount Moriah is the small hill that's attached to the southern hill of Mount Zion. Mount Moriah is where the temple was. Option number 6, the two bronze mountains are the natural barriers which divide kingdoms, according to Joseph Benson. Kyle and Delitz say the two mountains are symbols of the might of God, which is similar to option 3, which was the immovable decrees of God, his purposes which don't change. I report, you decide. We go now to Zechariah 6, verses 4 through 5. Then I spoke and said to the angel who was speaking with me, that's the interpreting angel who walks around with Zechariah explaining his 8 visions. Then I, Zechariah, spoke and said to the angel who was speaking with me, what are these, my lord? The angel replied to me, these are the 4 spirits of heaven, going forth after standing before the Lord of all the earth. Now, Why are the four angels going forth? There's a split of opinion on the purpose of those four spirits going forth. Option number one, they're going forth to judgment. Option number two, they're going forth to visit to see what's going on. Option number three, they're going forth to protect Israel. That's third option is my idea. I think that's what they're doing, those four chariots, those four spirits, those four angels. They're going out to keep peace in the land so the Israelites can build the temple. We go now to Zechariah 6, verses 6 through 8. With one of which the black horses are going forth to the north country. I need to back up, man. Pick up the last verse of verse 5, the last portion of verse 5. These are the four spirits of heaven, verse 6, with one of which the black horses are going forth to the north country, and the white ones go forth after them. So the spirits or the angels have horses. The black and white horses go to the north country, while the dappled ones go forth to the south country. Verse 7, when the strong ones went out, they were eager to go to patrol the earth. And he, capital H in the NASB, so I assume that's Yahweh. And Yahweh says, go patrol the earth. So they patrolled the earth. Then he cried out, Yahweh cried out to me and spoke to me, saying, see, those who are going to the land of the north have appeased my wrath in the land of the north. Now I need to point out a minor detail here. The angel going forth, he doesn't only have one horse, one black horse. He's got horses. Likewise, another angel has white horses, and both of them go north. The dappled horses and its associated angel go to the south, or their associated spirit. Verse 7, when the strong ones went out, they were eager to go to patrol the earth. Now that word, ha-aretz, could be land as well as earth. Now, I looked at my translations, and every last one of them, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 of them said it was earth. But it could be translated land, and to me that makes a little more sense, because then the verse would mean that the four chariots or the four spirits, they're patrolling Israel. The four angels are patrolling the land of Israel, which would then make it safe for the temple to be built. But on the other hand, you could say the four chariots are patrolling outside of Israel, patrolling the whole earth, so that nobody can attack Israel, so that rebuilding the temple would be safe. And of course, that's the whole point about these horses, is it's time to build the temple. Don't stop. Now, I've gone through this a million times already. Earth can be translated land, ha-aretz. I looked in a Hebrew lexicon. Earth for ha-aretz. Two definitions. One definition, earth. The whole earth as opposed to a part of the earth. The earth as opposed to heaven. The earth meaning the inhabitants of the earth. Or it can be translated land, which could be a country, a territory, a district, a region, a tribal territory, a piece of ground, the land of Canaan, Israel, inhabitants of the land, Sheol, land without return, the underworld, or a city-state. Well, let's just keep it simple, either land or earth. Now in verse 8, Yahweh cries out to Zechariah and says, see, those horses and the spirit of the black horses with the black horses and the spirit with the white horses, the angels, the two angels, those who are going to the land of the north. What's the land of the north? Well, that would be Babylon, because that's where Babylon came from. They would always go up the Euphrates Valley, go to the northwest, and then to the west, staying in the Euphrates Valley as the river bends to the west, and then they will come down north to south over the Euphrates River into Israel. And this makes sense to me. Babylon has caused more damage to Israel than any other country, maybe even than Assyria, really. But Assyria came from the north, too, for that matter. And so the north got two sets of horses, black and white, because from the north came the enemies that had caused the most damage to Israel. Now, these geographical mentions in these verses, 6, 7, and 8, to me, favor an interpretation of land for Ha-aretz and not the earth. You got a double patrol at the north of Israel. That's where Israel's enemies, Assyria and Babylon, traditionally came from. You got a dappled horse patrol at the south, where enemies like Edom and Egypt would come from. The west is not mentioned because the Mediterranean Sea is there. No enemies would come from there. And the east is not mentioned because there's a great desert between the Jordan River and the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, and no enemies would come from there. But it doesn't matter. It's either the land or the earth. The point is, the horses and the angels are patrolling. The land is at rest. Build the temple. When Yahweh says the horses going to the north have appeased my wrath, that means that God is taking care of Israel's enemies. The Babylonians are on ice, so it's time to get on with the building of the temple. We go now to Zechariah chapter 6, verses 9 through 10. The word of the Lord also came to me, saying, came to Zechariah, take an offering from the exiles, from Helde, Tobijah, and Judea. And you go the same day and enter the house of Josiah, the son of Zephaniah, where they have arrived from Babylon. Helde, Tobijah, and Judea are probably those to whom the gold and silver vessels of the temple were entrusted as the exiles came back from Babylon. And Josiah was probably a worker in gold and silver. Well, if Helde, Tobijah, and Judea are managing the gold and silver vessels, they are probably also handling the freewill offerings of gold and silver. And so from that gold and silver, there was going to be an offering made to make a crown. We read that in Zechariah 6, 11 through 13. Yahweh continues to speak to Zechariah, take silver and gold, make an ornate crown, and set it on the head of Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest. Then say to him, thus says the Lord of hosts, behold, a man whose name is Branch, for he will branch out from where he is, and he will build the temple of the Lord. Yes, it is he who will build the temple of the Lord, and he who will bear the honor and sit and rule on his throne. Thus he will be a priest on his throne, and the council of peace will be between the two offices. Now this ornate crown that was made of gold, it was set on the head of the high priest. A crown stands for kingly authority, and so we now have the high priest, Joshua, who's also a king. This is a perfect type for Jesus, because Jesus is also a priest and king. Melchizedek was also a priest king. He was another type of Jesus. Melchizedek was a priest. He was also king of Salem, if you recall from Genesis. Now, speaking of this priest king, the antitype Jesus, we have another prophecy of Jesus in verse 12. Then say to him, Yahweh is telling Zechariah to say to Joshua, thus says the Lord of hosts, behold, a man whose name is Branch. This is a perfect time to mention the prophecy about the Messiah, because Joshua the high priest is the type of the Messiah. This man is named Branch, for he, that's Jesus, will branch out from where he is. Now this prophecy of the branch was prophesied by Zechariah himself several chapters back in Zechariah 3, verse 8. Yahweh is speaking. He says, listen, Joshua the high priest, you and your colleagues sitting before you, and that's probably the other priest, indeed, these men are a sign that I am about to bring my servant, the branch. The other priests are a sign because they're priests. Joshua's a priest, and Jesus is going to be a priest. There are other places in the Old Testament besides Zechariah where the branch is prophesied about. Isaiah 4, verse 2, in that day the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth will be the pride and the adornment of the survivors of Israel. Isaiah 11, verses 1 and 2, then a shoot will spring from the stem of Jesse, and a branch from his roots will bear fruit. The shoot and the branch are the same thing. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and strength, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. Also, Jeremiah prophesies about the branch. Jeremiah 23:5, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will raise up for David a righteous branch, and he will reign as king and act wisely and do justice and righteousness in the land. Well, what is the metaphor here? Jesse was the stump. He was the founder of the Davidic dynasty. Well, he wasn't a stump at first. He was the base of the tree. The tree grows up. The Davidic kings rule Israel all the way from David and Solomon down to Zedekiah, who ruled from 597 to 586. Zedekiah was killed by the Babylonians, and so Jesse's tree is cut down, leaving only a stump. Stumps look like they're dead, but stumps will grow little shoots, little branches out from the stump in the next growing season. And so the stump is Jesse, but that little shoot is growing out, still of the house of David, still of the house of Jesse. That little shoot, that little branch is Jesus. He will branch out from where he is. What does branch out mean? Let's look at some translations. The ASV, the American Standard Version, and the KJV has, he will grow up out. The Bible in Basic English says, the branch under whom there will be fertile growth. The Darby translation says, he will grow up from. He will grow up from where he is. God's Word, Holman Christian Study Bible, the NASB says he will branch out from where he is. The NASB note says he will sprout up from where he is. The New American Bible says he will sprout from where he is, and the Young's Literal Translation says he will shoot up from where he is. Well, what does that mean? Well, option number one, he will shoot up or sprout up or grow up out of the tribe of David. This is Benson's view, Colin Delitzsch's view, Poole's view. Option number two, he will shoot up from where he is, stands for Jesus' miraculous conception. This is Joseph Benson. I think that's off the wall. I don't think that's what it means. Option number three, what does it mean for the Messiah, the branch, to shoot up, to sprout up, to grow up out from where he is? Option number three says that means Jesus will grow from lowliness to eminence. That's the Colin Delitzsch view and also the pulpit commentary view. And, of course, it could mean both. He will grow up out of the tribe of David. He will spring up from the tribe of David, and he will go from lowliness to eminence as he grows. Now, he will sprout up or grow up or shoot up from where he is. What does the where mean? Well, that means from the nation of Israel. That's where he was. The Colin Delitzsch and pulpit commentator say that, and I think that's correct. Now, the next thing the branch will do at the end of verse 12, he will build the temple of the Lord. Well, that's easy. Temple of the Lord in the New Testament is the church, the place where the Holy Spirit resides. The pulpit commentator says that. I didn't even look at other commentators because it's so obvious what the reference is here. Verse 13, Yahweh continues speaking to Zechariah, and Zechariah is supposed to relay this to Joshua, the high priest. Verse 13, yes, it is he, the branch, the Messiah, who will build the temple of the Lord, the church, and he who will bear the honor and sit and rule on his throne. On his throne, he's a king. Bearing the honor means, according to Clark, he will wear the insignia of kingly glory. And then, at the end of verse 13, thus he will be a priest on his throne. A priest on a throne. That means he's a king because he's on the throne, and he's a priest because he's a priest. And so you have two of the offices of the Messiah merged into one person, Jesus, the branch. Of course, he's also a prophet. Prophet's not mentioned here. The council of peace will be between the two offices, Yahweh says at the end of verse 13. Council of peace means peaceful understanding. What does that mean? Option number one, there will be peace between the offices of priest and king. Historically, there was often conflict between the high priest and the king, especially in the Maccabean period. But in the case of the Messiah, there will be perfect harmony between those two offices. Jesus is the perfect king, and he's the perfect priest. Now, this peace between priest and king is not referring to peace between Zerubbabel, the governor, and Joshua, the high priest. One might be tempted to think that, but I don't think that's in mind here. So, option number one, council of peace means peace between the offices of priest and king. And notice the verse itself says the council of peace will be between the two offices, at least in the NASB 95 translation. However, I should point out that the Holman Christian Study Bible merely has, there will be peaceful counsel between the two of them. It doesn't specify what the two are. Option number two as to what council of peace means comes from Albert Barnes. Barnes says that this phrase means a council which procures peace, not a council which is peaceful, but a council which actually brings about peace. Albert Barnes, citing the famous 5th century Catholic commentator Jerome, says that the peace is peace between God the Son and God the Father, the second and first persons of the Trinity. I don't think so. I think it refers to the two offices merged together into the person of the Messiah, the way the NASB translation has it. We go now to verses 14 and 15 of Zechariah 6, and we will finish this audio. Now the crown will become a reminder. This is still Yahweh speaking to Zechariah. Now the crown will become a reminder. This is the crown that was just made to put on the head of Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest. Now the crown will become a reminder in the temple of the Lord to Helam, Tobijah, Jedaiah, and Hen, the son of Zephaniah. Those who are far off will come and build the temple of the Lord. Then you will know that the Lord of hosts has sent me to you, and it will take place if you completely obey the Lord your God. Now, how will that crown be a reminder? Option number one, the crown will remind people that the Messiah will be a king who rules over his temple, the church. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown suggest that the crown will be a memorial to the donors who gave the money. I don't think so. I think that it's a reminder that the Messiah will be a priest king. Well, maybe the crown could be considered a memorial to the donors, because verse 14 says that the crown is a reminder to those four characters, Helam, Tobijah, Jedaiah, and Hen, and they're the ones that were handling the money, the donated money, into the treasury. So maybe Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown is actually closer to the truth than I gave them credit for. I don't know why Helam, Tobijah, Jedaiah, and Hen needed to be reminded that the Messiah was coming and he would be a priest king. They all needed to be reminded of that, but those four guys were in charge of the money. So maybe Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown are right. It's a reminder to these four guys that the money was given for this crown. Now, I need to talk about these four guys. They probably sound familiar because I read in verse 10 there were four guys who were in charge of the money, but they weren't quite the same. In verse 10 of this chapter, we had Heldai as the first gentleman, but in verse 14, we have Helam. So the commentators assume that Helam is the same as Heldai. The second character is Tobijah. He's the same in both verses. The third character is Jedaiah. He's the same in verse 10 and verse 14. The fourth character is Hen in verse 14. And in verse 10, he's Josiah. And there's a heap of difference between Hen and Josiah. However, this is what Albert Barnes says. There is no ground apparent to us why the name Helam appears instead of Heldai, or Heldai, or Hen for Josiah. Yet the same person must have been called both Hen and Josiah, since the father's name is the same in both places. They're mentioned in the list of the exiles who came back from Babylon. It's a minor point. It doesn't matter. We're going to assume they're the same four guys. Now in verse 15, we read, those who are far off will come and build the temple of the Lord. Who are those who are far off? Option number one, it's the Gentiles who will be a part of Messiah's temple, the church. Now, the immediately preceding context favors that because we have the branch, the Messiah, building the temple, and those who are far off will build that temple. That makes perfectly good sense. But there's another option. Option number two, the temple that is going to be built from those who are far off would be the physical temple, not a spiritual temple of the church, but a physical temple. And those who are far off would be exiles coming from Babylonia or from the rest of Persia, as John Gill says. Let me quote from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, who tends to agree with that. He says, primarily, however, the return of the dispersed Israelites from afar to the King of the Jews at Jerusalem is intended to be followed secondly by the conversion of the Gentiles from far off. So Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says it's both. Return of physical people to build the temple, and that's a type of the Gentiles coming into the church to build the New Testament temple. Here's what Adam Clark says. The kings of Persia contributed to the building of the temple and the finishing of it. We read that in Ezra 7:19 and Ezra 7:20. And in after times, Herod the Great and others that were strangers helped to beautify and enrich the temple. So, from afar off, kings of Persia and Herod the Great helped build the temple, physical temple. Well, whatever it means, I'm sure it means both. This contributes to the theme of Zechariah. Build the temple in the Old Testament. Build the second temple in the New Testament. Build the church. Now, in verse 15, we have a time word. Then you will know that the Lord of hosts has sent me to you. Now, the first thing we need to look at is that there are two options as to who is speaking here. It could be Yahweh speaking to Zechariah, in which case he would be saying, you, Zechariah, will know that I, Yahweh, have been sent to you. Or it could be, option number two, that Zechariah is speaking to the Israelites. He's saying, you Israelites will know that Yahweh has sent me, Zechariah, to you. Well, I'm going to assume the second option. Now, if this is true, that Zechariah is saying that he will be known when the temple is rebuilt, we have a problem if the temple is the New Testament temple that's being rebuilt, because then the Israelites would not be alive, and so the statement would be irrelevant. So, how will the Israelites know that Yahweh has sent Zechariah to the Israelites? Well, if the physical temple is being referred to, there's no problem. When the people see the temple rebuilt, they will know that God has sent Zechariah. Now, if you still want to hold to the view that it's the New Testament temple that's going to be a sign that Yahweh has sent Zechariah to the Israelites, you would have to make the you refer to all of Israel, present and future. Then Israel will know that Zechariah is a true prophet. Adam Clark has that view, but I don't think it's reasonable. When will Zechariah know that the Lord of hosts has sent Zechariah to you Israelites? Well, if this refers to the far-off times of the Messiah, the branch building the church, well, then the Israelites that Zechariah is ministering to are not going to know that. They'll be dead. So how will the Jews in Jerusalem know that God has sent Zechariah to them? Well, when the physical temple is built. When Zechariah sees the temple rebuilt, and when the people see the temple rebuilt, the people will know that Zechariah has been sent to them. Now, Adam Clark has another way out of the difficulty. He says the "you" there refers to all Jews, future as well as present. Then you will know, you Jews will know, including the Jews in the far-off future in the New Testament times. I don't think so. The "you" there sounds to me like Zechariah is talking to the people that are his contemporaries, and they're going to know that Zechariah is a true prophet. And this will take place, what? It will take place, the rebuilding of the temple, the second temple, the physical temple. It will take place if you completely obey the Lord your God. Again, God's blessings are always contingent upon obedience. And on that, we are finished with Zechariah chapter 6. We're now prepared to go to Zechariah 7 in our next audio, which I will call a call for justice and mercy. I hope you stay with me for the discussion of chapter 7, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.